You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
the United States is fully lifting the ban on the sale of military equipment to Vietnam that has been in place for some 50 years and removes a lingering vestige of the Cold War.
President Obama has lifted the US arms embargo on Vietnam. What will this mean for diplomatic relations between the former foes? My guests, Michael Goldfarb and Victor Bulmer-Thomas, will also discuss Austria's nail-biting presidential election. And
this was the scene of the 20th anniversary review of NATO naval forces. The weather was fine, and the ships, dressed overall and spick and span, made a grand sight as the Royal Yacht Britannia steamed up and down the lines of fighting ships to acknowledge each in turn.
Pay attention at the back, you pair. We'll be finding out about the Polish schoolchildren who could be fitting in NATO lessons into their timetables. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today are Victor Bulmer-Thomas, Associate Fellow at the Americas Programme at Chatham House, and Michael Goldfarb, who's an author and broadcaster for the likes of Politico.eu. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start with this.
We've agreed to continue deepening our defence cooperation, including patrol boats and training for Vietnam's Coast Guard, and to work more closely together in responding to humanitarian disasters. And I can also announce that the United States is fully lifting the ban on the sale of military equipment to Vietnam that has been in place for some 50 years. As with all our defense partners, sales will need to still meet strict requirements, including those related to human rights. But this change will ensure that Vietnam has access to the equipment it needs to defend itself and removes a lingering vestige of the Cold War.
President Obama announced earlier today that the United States is lifting a decades-long ban on the sale of military equipment to Vietnam. Obama said that the removal of the ban on lethal weapons signals greater cooperation with its former foe. But is this agreement solely aimed at countering China's strength in the region? Victor, when you hear this deal, does it make sense to you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I can see why United States might want to do this, but I think it's entirely the wrong thing.
An entirely the wrong thing because they shouldn't be given the arms, or America shouldn't give up its leverage on the US, as we said, for issues around human rights, for example.
No, it's. I mean, clearly normal relations between the United States and Vietnam are highly desirable, and they should come about as quickly as possible. But normal relations doesn't normally include selling lethal weapons. The bar for selling lethal weapons should be extremely high. There should be some pressing reason for it. And as you heard in that clip, we are told that it's for Vietnam's defense. Well, defense against whom? I mean, clearly this is a veiled reference to China, but China's relationship with Vietnam is difficult, but it's not threatening it militarily. And the other reason given was for humanitarian purposes. Well, you don't need lethal weapons in order to deal with humanitarian situations.
Michael, when we heard this story today, the Chinese news sites are saying, yes, we know that we have some difficulties with our neighbour Vietnam over what's happening in the Pacific, you know, over these disputes over many islands. But in the end, we are more of a political partner with Vietnam than the US can ever be. Do you think the US hopes to kind of slightly insert a wedge between that relationship?
Well, it's been one of the I wouldn't say themes, because it's been too juddering. But whenever he has a spare moment, the president has spent a great deal of time inserting himself into and trying to create a new Pacific security architecture. The problem for him is that he's been, you know, so hamstrung by what's been happening with the Middle East disintegrating that he hasn't had time to fulfill this. And I think that there may well be a motivation for his stepping forward. I don't know about the details of the arms sales and what particular weapons are being discussed. I mean, I would also say that if you step back a bit, there is, as he makes his final lap as president, it is of a piece, I think, probably in his own mind, that he's the president who opened the door to Cuba and to an attempt at normalizing relations in a country where those of us, you know, who pay attention understand that the human rights situation in Cuba isn't by any means at the level it should be. And now he's doing Vietnam, which, you know, for an American of a certain age, the idea that a president of the United States within months has normalized relations with Cuba and is embracing Vietnam in the way that he is and selling weapons is quite extraordinary. And I think that this is also about his legacy as well as any strategic purpose.
Victor, when you look at the broader lineup of U.S. policy in the region, we have seen discussions with Japan about easing up there, the kind of restrictions over its military might. We've had discussions with the Philippines about more U.S. troops being based in the country, again supporting that nation's, you know, reemergence as a slightly tougher military partner. And now these discussions with Vietnam. Do you think all of those conversations are wrong in their very nature because you're unsure about the selling of the lethal weapons? Or is it something in particular about the Vietnamese situation that you feel that the government isn't the right partner to be dealing with?
No, it's not that. It's just that lethal weapons are very dangerous things, and there has to be a very serious reason for granting them. And I suspect that this is gesture politics, because Obama also made it very clear in his remarks that he doesn't actually expect these weapons to be sold, because they won't pass through congressional conditions regarding human rights questions. So it's gesture politics. And as Michael said, this is very much part of the story of his last few months in office. And I don't think that's a sensible way to conduct policy. And I don't think it's a very sensible legacy to leave his successor, whoever he or she may be.
But in the balancing of power within the Pacific region, if you look at China, you feel that, you know, that we see these atolls being built up. We see attempts by China to kind of really extend its control over the region. Should I know that the notion of something should be done is never always the right thing to say, but should there be an attempt to somehow kind of counter that, the weight that China is putting in this issue?
Well, if anyone imagines that stopping China pursuing an expansionary policy in the South China Sea can be achieved by selling lethal weapons to Vietnam, they must be seriously demented, because China isn't going to be put off course by this one little bit. In fact, it'll just be A, irritated, and B, almost slightly derisory, I would have thought, in its attitude to the United States as a result.
Michael, on the broader question of the easing of relations, you know, these two extraordinary former foes, it's fascinating how the hatchet has been buried in so many ways, and in part, I guess, because there were so many Vietnamese people who went to the US who've now returned. The relations between families have been easier. But it is interesting, you know, that in a way, here's a country where many, many Americans died, where the rift was as deep as you can imagine, and they've managed to move on in their relationship, as it were. Whereas you say with Cuba already, it's, you know, it draws too many kind of painful, you know, issues even now. And with somewhere like Iran, you can hardly imagine them becoming that kind of buddy again. Why do you think it is with Vietnam that it has been easier for the US to kind of find its way back to be, you know, a diplomatic friend?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. There was one of the most interesting things, this is a cultural thing, is the degree to which the exodus of Vietnamese to the United States. I mean, we're talking about a war that took place 50 years ago, essentially. So people are now in their second, in some cases, you know, their grandchildren coming along. And the ease of travel over the last 10, 15 years has meant that people have been able to go back. There's been a lot of, you know, literature, articles, even films about identity questions asked by young people of Vietnamese heritage born in America, but who go back and they speak with their families and they learn things about that. There's been a tremendous amount of really good fiction written by former Vietnam veterans who've gone back. It has been possible for men who fought in some of the bloodiest battles of the war, to go back and revisit the battlefield sites and pay homage to the places where their friends died. And I think that that whole process, it's been very, you're right to point a finger in that direction, Andrew, has been very, very unique. And I think it's a tribute as much to something, and I've not been to Vietnam, but something in the Vietnamese character that has allowed the people of Vietnam to look beyond the war and the former enemy and to embrace it. I mean, besides which, tourism is huge in Vietnam, you know that. And I actually expect a similar thing will happen in Cuba over the next 24 to 36 months as more and more Americans go back. But more importantly, more and more Cuban Americans of the third generation now go back and explore the land that their grandparents left behind in the 1950s and early 1960s. And I think that it will be possible, again, because of business, for people to come together more rapidly there. And it's interesting that you should mention Iran, because you know there's a million people of Iranian heritage living in Los Angeles alone. They call it Tehrangeles. And it would be very, very interesting to see what would happen if the theocracy disappeared one day, see how quickly fences could be mended.
Victor, your take, is your perception of the easing of the relationship similar?
Well, I don't, I'm not so familiar with the cultural issues as Michael is. I'm perfectly happy to accept what he said about that. It clearly is a relationship that should have healed a long time ago. There are very solid reasons why the United States and Vietnam should now have good relations, not just normal relations. That doesn't have to include selling lethal weapons, as I've made clear. But Vietnam is a partner in the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership that the United States has negotiated with 12 countries. So, yes, I mean, it's frankly long overdue.
Well, we move on because it's been confirmed in the past few hours that Alexander van der Bellen has won Austria's presidential election and has prevented Norbert Hofer from becoming the EU's first far-right head of state. The election went right to the wire, but postal votes helped the pro-EU candidate, who was also backed by the Green Party, over the winning line. Michael, really fascinating. It's like 0.3 of a percent between the two of them. It was not until the postal votes were counted that kind of tipped it in the favour of van der Bellen. But why in the end do you think the Austrians did in big enough numbers decide that they were not going to back the far right?
Well, I don't know. It's very close, and the results only just been announced, and you know, can't fast forward reality, and we'll see if there's a challenge to that. I mean, there are quite a few postal ballots.
I think he's already kind of accepted that, you know, it's a lost deal. He said on his website, you know, I want to carry on this discussion. I feel that it's a sad moment, but I think he accepts the deal. Okay. And in the end, you know, if you lose by 0.3%, you still lose. You know, you are not going to run Austria.
Bernie Sanders supporters do not accept a 0.3% defeat, as you know. And I bet you Donald Trump won't either. Look, Austria has a long history of flirting very heavily with attractive young men from the countryside who are nationalist, far-right people. I mean, Jörg Haider, you'd have thought Jörg Haider was the prime minister of Austria for as well-known as he became. He was simply from Carinthia. He was the head of state government in Carinthia in the mountains. There is a strong strain within Austria, within Austrian society, that embraces a kind of, to me, recidivist nationalism that we could do without. But having said that, it comes against a backdrop of their next-door neighbor, Hungary, has embraced right-wing nationalism in the form of the Fidesz party, with the Jobbik party very close to being the second largest party. And we know that in Poland in the recent elections, again, right-wing nationalism is working its way across Central Europe. It seems to be a default setting. We look on it with great disapproval. I think that it we can never expect that it goes away, is what it comes to.
Victor, when we were talking here about the rise of the populist politician in Europe, but of course in the US as well, just before we come back to Austria, when you look at the US landscape, when you look at a Trump, do you think they're cut from the same cloth, these candidates?
No, I think Trump is rather sui generis. And we push the parallels with Europe probably at our peril. And that's perhaps a discussion for another day. But I think Michael is absolutely right that we have to put this vote in Austria in the context of European politics more generally. And although Austria is the story of the day, you know, tomorrow it'll be another country. And it's not that long ago, let's not forget, that the French voters were being asked in the second round of the presidential election to vote for the thief, not the fascist. And that was Chirac against Le Pen. Now, I'm not, of course, saying Van Bellen is a thief, far from it. Please don't get me wrong about that. But the point is that this monster has been around for a long time. And each time you get a situation like this, the far right seems to gain more respectability. There are politicians in this country, for example, like Nigel Farage, who would have been regarded as, you know, just beyond the pale 20 years ago, and who are now greeted on all the mainstream channels as if they were just normal, ordinary politicians. And I think that's a very depressing situation, but Michael's right. We will have to live with this for some time to come.
Michael, the key issue, obviously, here for all these parties seems to be migration more than anything else, in a sense of controlling national borders, having some control over your own destiny. And again, as you pointed out, is often people who are outside of the cities who fear this most. The migration story of last summer has changed in its nature and narrative for now. The numbers are definitely fewer coming via, obviously, Greece and from Turkey because of the situation there. Do we feel that this has been a high tide for these populist parties because of that? And that if there is a sense that migration levels are going back to how they once were, that actually the rise of the far right will lose some of its heat?
I don't know. I mean, probably the better thing to graph would be when the European economy as a whole is doing poorly, and also when individual national industries do poorly, and you go through a period of time when the stability of employment is challenged. In a sense, that's been what's driven the drift rightward in Central Europe and, I guess, up into the Baltics, for that matter, since 2008. And, you know, several years ago, I made a couple of trips to Hungary, to Poland, Ukraine, which is not part of the European Union, to report on rising anti-Semitism. And there are no Jews left, but they've got rising anti-Semitism because it's an expression of nationalist fervor to say we are Hungarians and Jews aren't, or whatever. And that was completely linked to the problems, the economic problems. So in a sense, the influx of a million refugees has just been an extra jerry can of petrol thrown on a smoldering fire anyway. And it wasn't helped by, I guess, in retrospect, I mean, those of us who live in cities might applaud Angela Merkel last autumn saying, well, we can take a million. It's easy enough. She may be right. You know, this is a phenomenon very much of city people tend to be more cosmopolitan, not so worried, but they're still countryside, and they're still the former industrial cities, which are now well into their transition away from, you know, industrial work. And this is all fertile territory for right-wing nationalists. The question is, can enough people move to big cities and become used to living with a diverse neighborhood before it explodes.
And Victor, I was going to bring you back here because you said, you know, that Mr. Trump is of, you know, is his own category, as it were. But actually, when you look at the list of, you know, the checklist of things that offend these people, it's, you know, Islam does not belong here. We need to control our borders, whether that's, you know, telling the Mexicans they're going to pay for a wall across your southern rim, or whether it's, you know, the Austrians, you know, putting back in place border controls. I crossed the Austrian border not recently, and, you know, there in Italy, in France, you know, borders are back. They're back, whether people claim that Schengen still exists or not. They're properly back. Don't you think that there is a bit of a kind of familiar ground around religion and around migration that actually does unite all these people?
Well, the last time I checked, there weren't many Muslims crossing from Mexico into the United States. And so it would be, I think, very wrong to think that Trump's Islamophobia is what is getting people excited about him in the primaries. Of course, he's whipped up anti-Mexican feeling on the basis of a tiny, tiny number of cases, which he's dragged out of all proportion. And that the lesson of that is not that... why can't he go away and just disappear? Because clearly he won't. The lesson is that somebody has to be able to tell a proper positive story about migration. Politicians used to do that. We easily forget that. There is a very positive story to be told. But clearly you can't have it both ways. You can't talk about the economic benefits of migration and how migrants normally go into the workforce, they pay their taxes and so on, and then not be willing to spend additional money on health and education and all the other issues where inevitably migrants will add to the demand. We seem to be wanting to have our cake and eat it, and that's irresponsible.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Michael Goldfarb and Victor Bulmer-Thomas. Coming up next, should school children have to learn about NATO as part of their curriculum? But first this.
What is culture with Robert Bound?
This is the show of shows. There was something really magical about it.
Everybody's boozing, having grand adulterous love affairs. There's fabulous fist fights, and everybody is smoking opium.
How did that get in there? Well, we're not enjoying the after party. We're on an intrepid investigation each week to answer questions like how do you adapt a novel and how do you start an art collection? Culture with Robert Bound is your one-stop shop for the answers to the cultural questions that leave you scratching your head every day. Grab a drink, pull up a chair and tune in every Monday at 1900 London time.
Welcome back to Midori House. A state of emergency, changing time zones and an economic crisis that has forced civil servants to work a grueling two-day week. All is not well in Venezuela. And if things weren't bad enough, the country's embattled president, Nicolas Maduro, said at the weekend that he was preparing Venezuela against threats of a foreign invasion. Well, still with me are Michael Goldfarb and Victor Bulmer-Thomas. Apologies. Victor, the idea that the US is planning an invasion of the country seemed ludicrous to outsiders. But do you think that America perhaps does see an opportunity here to influence events within the country?
Of course. I mean, that's the job of international relations. But it's more a case of going back to the Old Testament. Thou shalt not kill, but need not strive to keep alive. Clearly, the Obama administration is not planning an invasion. That is a ridiculous claim. But they certainly won't be at all unhappy at the prospect of Maduro falling, either as a result of a military coup or through a recall referendum or whatever it is. And I've no doubt at all that they're feeding the necessary information to the opposition, wherever it comes from.
But do you think there is, with working with the opposition, any hope that the US can genuinely, you know, change the timetable of what's happening within the country?
Well, there are several actors here which are absolutely crucial. Probably the most important is the Venezuelan military, which, like all militaries, will have divisions in a situation like this. It's a military which is fairly corrupt. And that means that there are strong interests to protect among some of the senior officers, and they could lose all of that if they're not careful. So I'm absolutely certain that they will be in some sort of communication with the opposition, although I wouldn't like to predict an immediate military coup or anything like that. Then you have the opposition itself, which is trying to pursue the constitutional route, which is to garner enough signatures to proceed towards a recall referendum, which is what happened when Hugo Chavez was president. As it happened, Chavez won the recall referendum, but there was one as a result of collecting the signatures. And that would be, I think, by far a preferable outcome, but Maduro has temporarily at least closed that down. But we will see, because ultimately it's going to come down to the courts to decide whether those signatures that have been collected are legitimate or not. And then there are the neighbors. We shouldn't always assume that it's what the U.S. wants that matters. The neighbors have a strong interest, from Colombia to Brazil to Argentina and Central America. And they are obviously very keen to try and get Venezuela back to some sort of normality. And I could go on, but you get the point that we have to take into account all the different actors here and not just the United States government.
Michael, extraordinary that description of the country. And what's fascinating is for outsiders, is when you look at a Zimbabwe, you think, okay, here are these countries where people are in poverty, the economy is kind of collapsed. It seems pretty transparent what would make the situation easier. Yet somehow, the governments cling on. There is no popular revolt. There were reports at the weekend that even in many of the communities that were staunch supporters of Hugo Chavez, that today even those communities are feeling actually that this kind of deal isn't going very well now. But still, Maduro clings on, saying it's all down to the oil price. It's all an international conspiracy. And the opposition is going down, as we said, the legitimate route for a change of government. Does it strike you extraordinary that it just carries on?
Well, it's interesting you bring up Zimbabwe. The difference, I would say, is that the one time I was in Venezuela, which is going back some years now, and Chavez was still alive, and I learned very quickly that things such as Victor has been describing simply wouldn't happen, that because he came from the military, he still had very strong connections back into the general staff. He had his loyalists. Their military wasn't going to come out of its barracks to do anything, even when the economy was spiraling out of control. And, Caracas had become, a pretty deadly place to walk around in after sunset. This is different. It feels different, one, because the oil price has collapsed. It's not coming up anytime soon. The shortages are profound. And it's possible the difference between here in Zimbabwe is that, Mugabe is a Chavez figure. I mean, he had all of this something that we from the outside don't get that connects him up to the common people.
Yeah, there seems to be a bit of a charisma deficit.
I'm not sure that Maduro has this. And, so it's also possible that this time around there'll be an incident. And if there's an incident and the army has to come out and quell something in the street, there'll be another incident. And then you have the beginning.
Okay, well, there may be another incident if I don't fit in the final story. Because there's this.
This was the scene of the 20th anniversary review of NATO naval forces. The weather was fine, and the ships, dressed overall and spick and span, made a grand sight as the Royal Yacht Britannia steamed up and down the lines of fighting ships to acknowledge each in turn.
Polish schoolchildren could be taught about NATO alongside lessons in civic studies and national history. The government plans to give schools the option of teaching classes about the world's most powerful military alliance. Victor, a good idea?
It all depends which history they teach. Are they going to teach the Russian version of NATO or the US version of NATO?
I've got a feeling it's the US one.
Exactly. And that's the point, that this isn't history. This is politics. And so we shouldn't confuse the two.
Michael, just a few seconds. Yes or no?
Well, something. I wonder if they'll teach. Ask them, do you think really that NATO would come to your aid if the Russians decide to roll into the Baltic states or come over the border into Poland? Because that's the real question that we all need to be discussing in a civics lesson.
answers in less than 1,000 words, please. Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Michael Goldfarb, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. And that's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Hannah Ritchie, and Maria Granina. And our studio manager was Toby Hammett. And more music next from 1900 Hours, it's Culture with Robert Bound. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say thank you for listening and goodbye.